When you look at the news, you know, whether it's the Arab Spring or these massive protests in Latin America, it can all look so spontaneous.
It does. It feels chaotic, almost random, like a sudden outburst of anger.
Exactly. But what we found in this deep dive is that political turmoil is, well, anything but random.
Right. It actually stems from these definable, deep-rooted structural causes. So today we're going to get beneath the headlines and try to understand the systemic forces that are really at play.
Yeah, the forces that determine whether society just bends under pressure or completely breaks.
We're on a mission here to figure out what those foundational cracks are, the things that make a political system, vulnerable to collapse.
And we have a fantastic body of research to draw on. I mean, it goes back centuries, from Marx all the way to modern economists like Acemoglu.
All of them are trying to map this incredibly complex relationship between economic growth and a state's political capability. It's about where systems find their resilience.
And what happens when that engine of socioeconomic change just goes way too fast for a nation's institutions to keep up?
That's the core question.
Okay, so let's start with a really crucial distinction when we're talking about political risk. It can be exogenous, so from the outside, or endogenous coming from within.
And the exogenous risks are the ones you'd spot pretty easily. We're talking interstate conflict, regional wars, large-scale terrorism.
But it's the endogenous risks, the internal ones, that really tear a society apart from the inside.
Absolutely. And our research, it consistently points to a few key internal drivers, things like internal violence, cultural or ethnic fragmentation.
And that explosive pace of urbanization,
Yeah.
right? Sometimes coupled with religious fundamentalism.
Yes. But above all, the two big ones are economic recession and that massive, massive wealth gap.
Which lands us right on inequality. It's cited over and over again as just this fundamental root cause of sociopolitical turmoil.
And you can't talk about that without bringing in the classic Marxist approach to state power. It's a pretty radical claim, but the idea is that conflict just naturally arises when the way we make things, the forces of production, clashes with the existing social structure.
So who owns what?
Exactly. It's class struggle personified. And in this view, the state is not some neutral referee.
Not at all. The sources cite that famous definition. The state is just a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie.
Which is the ultimate anti-institutionalist viewpoint, really. It suggests that democracy is basically an illusion and that capitalism, just by its nature, creates more and more class polarization.
And that polarization is what drives the instability. You can see it so clearly in the data.
Oh, yeah.
Like the World Inequality Lab noted in 2023 that South Africa is one of the most unequal countries on Earth.
And when you have that kind of disparity, the whole structural foundation is just inherently shaky. It's predictably unstable.
So we can think of that massive wealth gap as the dry timber of instability, just waiting for a spark.
That's a perfect way to put it. And if the wealth gap is the dry timber, we need to look for the match.
The trigger.
The rapid proximal trigger that makes the whole thing ignite. And historically, the most reliable match is always food stress.
The link between the price of staple foods, especially wheat, and actual revolution is, well, it's startling.
It's that immediate stress point that pushes people from just complaining to actually revolting. I mean, look at the conditions leading up to the French Revolution.
In the 18th century, bread wasn't just a food, it was the food.
It was almost 50% of a French household's entire budget.
That's immense. Imagine if half your paycheck today only bought you bread. It's unthinkable.
And then on top of that, you get the catastrophic weather of 1788. So a severe drought and then just a viciously cold winter.
The sources detail it perfectly. 6 pounds of bread suddenly cost the equivalent of a full day's salary.
An entire day of work for one loaf of bread.
And that hyperinflation just kept going. It wasn't a bad year. It was existential starvation being driven by a price shock.
And that pattern, it just repeats. The sources connect this exact dynamic to the causes of the 2011 Arab Spring.
Right, correlating the upheaval directly with those huge spikes in global wheat prices between 2008 and 2018.
It shows how a systemic inequality can be exposed almost instantly by an economic shock.
So the key question becomes, how can we assess which political systems are tough enough to absorb that kind of shock without just falling apart?
And that's where political risk assessment gets, more analytical.
Yeah.
Figures like Ambassador Paul Bremer, they laid out the core questions you have to ask.
Like, how resilient is the political system itself, its institutions?
Is there a real tradition of peaceful transitions of power? And crucially, how strong are the social shock absorbers?
The safety nets.
The safety nets, the social cohesion, anything that provides a buffer, if those are weak, the whole system just fails that much faster.
This focus on resilience brings us to, I think, the core sociological explanation for modern instability.
It does. And decades ago, the sociologist Daniel Bell, he identified that capitalism is, well, structurally unstable.
He called it the cultural contradiction of capitalism, arguing that we're all caught in this tension.
A tension between the demands of work, discipline, saving, and the pressures of consumption, which is all about instant gratification.
And when those two forces collide, social stability just fractures.
But the most crucial insight on this, I think, comes from Samuel Huntington. He totally contradicted that simple idea that, oh, modernization just automatically leads to political stability.
Well, he argued the exact opposite.
Exact opposite.
And this is the concept of institutional lag, which is so vital for you to understand. Instability doesn't happen just because a country modernizes.
Right.
It happens because the political institutions fail to keep pace with that modernization.
Precisely. If you have rapid socioeconomic change, people moving to cities, getting more education, becoming wealthier, new groups get mobilized into politics.
They have new demands, new expectations.
Exactly. And if the political system doesn't have the capacity to integrate those demands peacefully, the whole thing just explodes.
Huntington basically gave us the instability formula.
He did.
Instability equals rapid social change plus mobilization of new groups.
Hmm.
Which is greater than the development of political institutions.
It's an ironclad rule. If your government can't manage the stress of social change, you get violence and disorder.
So the key takeaway is that a deficit in institution building is the direct cause of social upheaval.
Yeah. If you grow your economy quickly, but you don't grow the load-bearing walls of your governance, you are guaranteeing a crisis down the line.
Which forces us to confront this huge debate among economists.
Hmm.
What is the true source of prosperity? Is it the institutions, or is it just raw economic growth?
And you basically have two major schools of thought here. On one side, you have thinkers like Hayek, who argued that institutions are more or less a fixed variable.
Exogenous.
Right. For them, growth comes from capital accumulation, technology, maybe just good geography. Growth comes first, institutions will follow.
But on the other side, you have the institutions-driven school, with people like Douglas North and Acemoglu.
And they argue, fundamentally, that the differences in socioeconomic institutions are the real source of prosperity. They define property rights, they shape incentives.
For Acemoglu and his colleague Robinson, history is destiny. They point out that colonial origins often created what they call extractive institutions.
Institutions designed to strip the population of opportunity and incentives, and that leads directly to poverty and instability.
While inclusive institutions lead to long-term prosperity.
And the comparison they use between Haiti and the Dominican Republic is maybe the most powerful illustration of this you could find.
It's incredible. They share the same island, Hispaniola.
Yeah.
And 50, 60 years ago, they had comparable economies.
But look at them now. The Dominican Republic has, despite its own challenges, maintained a representative democracy. Its GDP per capita is around $10,700.
Whereas Haiti, which has been plagued by just perpetual institutional failure and chaos, has a GDP per capita of only $2,000.
That enormous difference is almost entirely down to their diverging institutional stability.
So that seems to settle it, right?
Yeah.
Institutions have to come first.
You'd think so, but the evidence that the sources gather offers a really critical and kind of challenging nuance on that sequencing.
Okay.
It does. While institutions are obviously vital, some research suggests that human capital is actually a more basic source of growth.
And more to the point, that poor countries have sometimes used good economic policies,
often implemented by authoritarian regimes.
Right, to achieve really rapid growth. And then only afterward did they improve their political institutions.
But isn't that just a defense of authoritarianism? I mean, if we accept that you have to wait for growth before you get good institutions.
Well, you're guaranteeing massive social and political risks in the meantime. Risks the system, by definition, can't handle.
That's the essential political gamble. The evidence is complex. It suggests that while growth can give legitimacy to a dictatorship, it's no guarantee of stability.
Eventually, that rapid social change will create that Huntingtonian lag.
And it will demand institutional change whether the dictator wants it or not.
And regardless of the sequence, managing all this tension is just harder than ever in the modern era.
For a long time since the Industrial Revolution, the market economy and liberal democracy were seen as this virtuous couple.
But now they seem to be decoupling.
Well, they're inherently in tension, which institutions are supposed to manage. Markets are global. They aim for individual needs and efficiency. Democracy is local.
Bound by national laws, aimed at collective well-being.
And institutions are the channel for controlling the wealth gaps that markets create. But the sources emphasize that the West's loss of sort of political leadership is accelerating this global fragmentation.
The idea that exporting democracy was just inevitable is gone.
It's gone. Developing countries are now confidently choosing non-Western models, like the ones you see in China or Russia.
This leads to what the sociologist Jerome Fourquet calls the archipelago.
It's a powerful metaphor. Modernization, slower growth, wider wealth gaps, they all combine to erode a national identity.
So a nation fractures into a country.
Exactly. A country just shared by multiple ethnocultural groups with totally divergent interests.
So the institutions that were meant to aggregate everyone's interests just fail because there's no common ground anymore.
And that's where you get political polarization and gridlock. And when institutions are that weak, corruption is inevitable.
The political scientist Robert Klitgaard's famous equation is a useful tool here.
It is. C for corruption equals M for monopoly, plus O for opacity, plus D for discretion, plus LI for loose institutions, minus A for accountability.
So to fight corruption, you have to break up monopolies, you have to demand transparency, and you have to aggressively increase accountability.
The real-world cost of failing to do that is immediate. I mean, we see data from the 2024 African Youth Survey.
60%.
60% of young people are thinking about emigrating because they see rampant corruption as the single biggest obstacle to their own future. It's a massive brain drain.
And this institutional failure, it just feeds the global democratic recession we're seeing. Declining trust, rising wealth gaps, and the election of these illiberal populist leaders.
Populism is the direct political symptom of institutional lag. It's anti-institutionalist, it's anti-elitist.
It's driven by that core belief that the average person is being systematically ripped off by the establishment.
Right. And it promises radical reform. But the sources warn that all forms of populism, they harbor this intrinsic tendency to become a very dangerous runaway train once they're in power.
So after all this, what does it mean for you, the listener? We've seen that sustainable political stability really requires this difficult political stability triangle.
And that triangle is made of three things: institutional strengthening, dynamic economic growth, and socio-political inclusiveness.
While that rapid economic growth might offer, you know, short-term legitimacy to a dictatorship,
it's the robust and stable democratic institutions that are absolutely essential for the long-term, sustainable, and inclusive development that people actually want.
Our sources do suggest there's a potential virtuous cycle here. Democracy seems to breed GDP per capita growth, and economic growth pushes societies toward better democracy.
But, and this is the final thought for you to chew on, given the current global democratic recession, you have to wonder how rising wealth gaps and political fragmentation risk breaking that cycle entirely.
If the institutions collapse, we could see large populations returning to conditions where the immediate factor
and the cost of bread.
Exactly. The cost of bread and institutional failure become the main drivers of their political future, not democratic choice and stability. And that is the ultimate cost of political lag.